All lines are now bridged.
Okay. Welcome everyone to work group two, looking at exceptions under the information blocking task force. Quick roll call and we'll jump right in. Andy Truscott?
Present.
Michael Adcock? Do you believe he's on? Valerie Gray? Emil Jane?
Here.
Arian Malik?
Good morning still, at least my time.
Stephen Lane?
I'm in the same time zone as Arian. Good morning.
All right, well, good morning, guys. All right, I will turn it over to our co-chairs. Or Mark, did you have anything that you wanted to start with first, with revisiting any outstanding issues?
No, I mean, I think just to focus us, I believe we just left off last time with the 206 licensing on RAND terms. I think we need to get through that, our initial review, and then it would be, I'll leave it up to Andy to go back through and revisit the big topics.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Yeah, I want to finish off.
Actually, the request for information too, I guess, also, right? Sorry.
There were. Do you want to get those out now before we sort of get into it?
Yeah, sure. Do you want to finish up RAND licensing, or
you get the requests out because just get them done so I don't have to remember to come back to them later.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Can you all see my screen?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Great. Shoot. All right. All right. The first one is, and Arian raised this one this morning, we have a request for information on potential addition of an exception for complying with the common agreement for trusted exchange. So as background, we thought long and hard about having this exception, but because of the timing wasn't right with TEFCA, the request for information is what we ended up putting in the proposed rule.
And I think you heard a perspective this morning that having an affirmative set of obligations that provide at least the effect of a safe harbor, unless there's other nefarious behavior going on, would make it substantially easier to comply with the cures NPRM. And
yeah.
So
I guess just to push back a little bit, are you talking specifically about TEFCA or just more broadly, like laying out examples of practices that are okay?
That's a different thing.
I had a perspective that at some point ONC would line up the TEFCA and the information blocking exceptions such that doing the right thing was the easiest way to comply with information blocking provisions.
Gotcha.
So, you know, I think the general notion of an affirmative set of activities that a provider or health IT developer or health information exchange or health information network could comply with that at least are presumed to be good acting is necessary. And then in particular, I had an assumption that the TEFCA would outline such a set of activities.
That's fair.
I was labeling under the same presumption as well, that if you comply with TEFCA, you will be held not to be information blocking, to sum it up.
Well, yeah. So I just want to chime in because it seems to me that that's not a guarantee that, you know, some of the behaviors that we're all trying to prevent and avoid and call out if they occur, it just doesn't seem immediately obvious to me, again, not knowing what, you know, TEFCA is going to look like, that one would preclude the other. So, I mean, I've always paused on this whole safe harbor notion, and I guess I just want to understand it better. I mean, what makes you think that somebody in compliance with TEFCA wouldn't have some sort of minor behavior that we wouldn't want to watch for, you know, and potentially be able to call out. I can't come up with an immediate example in my mind, but it just doesn't seem to me intuitive that, you know, just being a good actor on TEFCA means that you wouldn't also have some behavior that's information blocking.
And the way that I phrased it was deliberate when I was trying to make the words appear out of thin air. But, you know, I said compliance with TEFCA in the absence of other significant indicators of information blocking would be presumed. So I agree with you that I think there are some cases where there may be some other behavior that itself is problematic. But at least it gives people an affirmative set of things to shoot for that create at least I've also used the word presumption of. Presumption doesn't mean that the behavior isn't going on. It just means that if I'm making data freely available via APIs to patients and to other requesters in accordance with permissible purposes, that I'm doing something right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll go a little bit further out. In the absence of having TEFCA defined, it's a bit difficult to say that yes, it's appropriate or no, it's not at this point.
Right.
I think all we have is, you know, our instinct that it would make sense if you complied with TEFCA, there at least was a presumption that you were not information blocking, and maybe there would be a shift in onus as to, you know, how these regulations would apply if you were complying with TEFCA. I don't know, because we haven't finished TEFCA yet. We are still in the request for information for Mark. Have you got anything else, Mark, to raise to us?
On that one specifically?
No, across the patch.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so there's another request for information. It's just a more general one about, in addition to possibly TEFCA down the road, to other new exceptions that you know, you feel might be appropriate to add as reasonable and necessary activity.
Yeah. So one thing that I raised in my incredibly long Twitter thread that I want to raise here is, and this may be deliberate or it may not be deliberate, is the notion of complying with contracts and BAA terms as constituting or not constituting information blocking. So, you know, I come at this at least at one level from the perspective of working through the issues involved in supplying information to patients as a clearinghouse. And this is something we'd very much like to do. But in areas where we have BAA terms that are restrictive or do not give us data use permission to do certain activities, the general rule is that we follow the BAA rather than follow, you know, a clearinghouse is a defined covered entity under HIPAA. But even though patient access is part of the responsibilities of a covered entity, when the BAA prohibits it, our stance right now, just from as a legal matter, is that we're prohibited. Complying with BAA terms and other contractual requirements is not a defined exception category. And so we would have to make a choice. I understand patient access is slightly different, so because I think you could argue that cures overrode BAA requirements for clearinghouses for patient access. But even in the case of, let's say, supplying claims data for the purposes of risk adjudication or clinical quality measurement, I think you can make the case that we would be deemed information blocking if we held by the BAA terms that we have with our counterparties.
So, Arian, aren't you really suggesting that the BAA terms may need to be adjusted to account for the information blocking regs?
Well, I want to make sure, number one, that ONC was deliberate about the not including BAA terms as an exception.
I mean, anyone can write anything they want into a BAA, right? I mean, that shouldn't be an excused information block.
So as a business associate, business associates have only the data use, have only the data uses that are granted to it by the covered entity. And so that's a matter under HIPAA. And typically HIPAA requires, minimum necessary, has a minimum necessary standard. So it could be, I am posing this as a question for ONC, and I don't know if it was covered in the commentary or covered anywhere. It could be that it was a deliberately not included exception such that it is intended that the cures obligations apply regardless of BAA terms. And Stephen, to your point, we'd have to update our BAA terms, or BAA terms would be null and void because they'd be superseded. Typically, contracts have language that, you know, if it's superseded by law, then that section is struck. But so we'd either have to update our BAA terms, or in the case of being sued by one of our counterparties, we could claim that Congress overrode the intent of Congress and the implementation of cures overrode those BAA terms. Right now, it's neither fish nor fowl, I guess. It's not explicitly stated that cures obligations override BAA terms, and it's not explicit, and it's clearly not listed as an exception.
Yeah, so I guess that's directed at me, and I'll say this: you're right. There's not an exception for that. That's accurate, and we also have some preamble language. You may have seen that addresses just broadly that we don't think that contractual obligation should be, an excuse for information blocking. But you know, we're open to suggestions about clarifying the issue.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've got HIPAA as a regulatory framework on the one hand that says that BAAs, BAAs have only the rights, data use rights that are provided for under BAA.
That is correct. Yep.
And then on the other hand, we have cures saying that in addition to those rights is a general purpose right to enable information exchange. And provide data for any permissible purpose.
Arian, educate me a little more. My understanding of BAA terms is that they are pretty flexible. You know, that in our organization, we have kind of standard BAA language that we start with, but then we make adjustments to suit the needs. Are you suggesting that there is sufficient specificity of what needs to be in a BAA that's defined by HIPAA that could be relied upon here?
I am not a lawyer, but I play one on FACAs, so at some point we may need additional clarification here. But my understanding of the way that HIPAA and BAAs work, and I've spent nearly as much time reading HIPAA as I have reading the information blocking exceptions, is that it works this way. Covered entities have a certain set of data use rights that are enumerated, so rights to PHI are enumerated in a broad set of rights under TPO. That are permitted purposes under HIPAA. There's a subset of those rights that are enabled for information exchange. And then BAAs have only the rights granted to them that are granted to them or effectively delegated to them BAAs, business associates, have only the data use rights that are delegated to them through the BAA. So as an example, as a clearinghouse, if a payer or a provider, if Sutter Health CPMC has a contract for Clearinghouse, and they say, "Dear Clearinghouse, you can use our data only for the purposes of transmitting, editing, and providing other necessary services sufficient to get it to the payers accurately," then we have as BAAs, or we have as a BA, only those rights.
As a business associate.
As a business associate, yep.
Right.
There's been a sense of ambiguity for clearinghouses, but this is actually a much more general matter because it applies to any BA that falls under the definition of health information network or health information exchange or health information, certified health information technology. There's been a level of ambiguity specific to clearinghouses, that clearinghouses are covered entities, but also generally subject to BAs. But if we take a health information exchange, I talked to a friend of mine who runs a health information exchange, whose contracts with providers and payers are restrictive in the sense of how data may be used. They may be used for treatment purposes, but they may not be used for pricing negotiation.
Right.
Pretty typical HIE terms where you've got payers and providers in the mix.
So, Arian, limitations. Anil, are you saying?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this is Anil. Are you saying then that that you would like either some recommendation from this group that they clearly spell out those BAAs and what must happen to those within 24 months in order so that there's nothing in there that would be construed
would like,
as information blocking? Is that
what I would like either a clear statement of preemption or a clear statement that BAA terms for data use are an exception. I would prefer, honestly, presumption, preemption, because as a clearinghouse, as a orders and results information exchange, as a provider of information exchange services broadly, there's a whole set of things we could do, for example, to provide patients transparency that we can't do right now. But we can't do them right now because they're in violation of our BAAs.
So you're saying that either the CURES needs to preempt the BAA terms, or complying with your BAA terms needs to be safe harbor under CURES, basically.
That's exactly right. And right now it is ambiguous, and I think it could be argued either way. And if anything that can be argued either way is going to generate lawsuits.
Well, I would just argue, as a civilian, that that CURES should preempt the BAA terms because CURES is newer and it's more progressive, I think, than HIPAA, which is the foundation of the BAA terms.
Actually, so my understanding, as CURES was being drawn, was that it was intended to preempt.
Relative to patient access, so there's very clear language in CURES that implies preemption with respect to patient access, but not with respect to other permissible purposes. And Mark, I'd welcome your comment here.
Sorry, I was just jotting some notes. Can you say that one more time?
So my understanding of CURES, so there's an argument that's being made, which is a reasonable argument, that CURES is more modern and more progressive and is, you know, sort of the newer rule and preemption should be clear. There's a statement that says, I think it was Andy who says he understood that CURES already did preempt. And my understanding of CURES is there's...
That's not what I said.
Yeah, okay,
said.
Sorry.
My understanding was the intention was that CURES would preempt.
Would preempt, okay. So my understanding of CURES as a piece of legislation is that there's specific language relative to patient access that could be construed as preemption, but that it, as I said, at this point, it's neither fish nor fowl, and I think it would be useful to clarify it.
Yes, I mean, I can't really speak to that. You know, I mean, CURES is legislation. while what we're trying to do is, you know, draft a regulation based on Congress's mandate and cures to, you know, lay out these reasonable and necessary activities that would not constitute information blocking. So I can't really speak to whether or not cures preempts other, you know, contracts or laws or anything like that.
So you understand the difficulty this places people in,
which is that
at one hand it's not an exception, on the other hand there are contractual terms, and so at some point it's going to have to come and be adjudicated, likely in a legal setting, and that's probably not a great place for policy to be.
Sure. No, I definitely understand your point. I think it's a clear point. I'd say that's why we have the request for comment and information.
Yep.
If you have a suggestion, about one way or the other, I understand the two options you laid out. So I think it's a good one for the group to consider.
Well, so can we agree as a group that we believe that preemption is the way to go and that it should be spelled out?
I'm not sure we all agree that. Arian, would you agree with that?
I already stated that I think we would prefer a clear statement of preemption, because I think there are some activities that we'd like to do that would provide more patient access and more access for quality measurement, risk analysis, that kind of thing. I'm not sure all of our customers would.
Yeah.
So, because they put those VAA terms in for a reason.
One thing I would point out is just when you're thinking about which option to go with, take a look at the preamble again. We do a number of instances talk about the problematic nature of contracts and how they tie into information blocking. So. As far as understanding ONC's intent on the issue, I'd refer you to preamble there.
Cool.
Okay.
Is there specific language?
Confess, my understanding was, you know, an awful lot of what got put in place for cures was because there was an intricate web of BAAs of many different flavors that had been woven, which were, you know, in part considered to be restricting information flow, and therefore with cures the attempt was to actually move beyond them and say, actually put them to one side, this is what we want to have happen.
Well this is Anil. I don't think I would say that was the intent to put VAAs aside. I think it's a very useful.
I overstepped in my language there, but it was preempt to this point.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that I think you'd get different opinions if you talk to the covered entities versus those who would want greater flexibility under the VAAs. I think the other language that I've seen throughout our discussions have been, you know, giving an amount of time to either revise or renegotiate those agreements. And I think this would fall under there, where all the entities would have 24 months to re-examine their BAAs and ensure that there are no information blocking practices that are in there. I think you need to give people time to renegotiate. I think Arian's point about there are things that he would like to do, I think can still be supported, because in that 24 months of redoing that BAA, an argument could be made. But I don't think we should get rid of the agreements that a covered entity make with a business associate just by simply, you know, waiving cures and saying all the agreements that were there, we can just get rid of them, because the intent of cures is to make information free flow. Yes,
yeah.
But there still needs to be some discussion between the covered entity and the business associate, and that 24 months, I think, is what I've seen in other places.
I still think it places some organizations in a poorly defined middle ground.
Yes.
So if if somebody comes to you and a payer comes to you and says, we need this data to adjudicate, to do risk management for this patient population, it's a legitimate purpose under cures. And for whatever reason, in the 24 months, you have not, your business, your the covered entities that you are a BA2 have not included BAA language that is in compliance with the general provisions of cures, you are then stuck between breaking a contract or being subject to penalty under cures, potentially under a False Claims Act, with potentially either OIG or False Claims Act enforcement.
Well, I get it, and I'm not a lawyer either, but it would seem to me that if there is any kind of federal statute that would always trump the BAA regardless. I think what you're saying is that the HIPAA privacy security provisions that make a BAA important, there's at least the way you're seeing it, that that's in conflict with the Cures Act. I get that, but I think there's otherwise, I think you're going to have too many folks who will make presumptions about what they're allowed to do with the preemption. And on the flip side, if we don't allow for that, renegotiating during that time period, then I think you might, end up having some unintended consequences of covered entities being accused of something that they're not really doing. And so I don't know if there needs to be some language about, time. And then what you're describing is the inadvertent, you're breaking your BAA, trying to comply with cures, comply with this interoperability rules, versus the other way around. I think this happens all the time where BAAs have been written, and then they need to be rewritten in order to compensate for, new mandates. I mean, are we saying that in other parts of this particular rule too, where they have 24 months to renegotiate agreements and contracts?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, I'm just looking in parallel at the language of contracts in the commentary, and almost all the language of contracts is relating to prohibitions that a health IT developer makes on a provider organization that are restrictive covenants and the like.
Right, right. And so what I'm saying is, let's extend that to covered entities and BAAs who have gone into an agreement with that is now needs to be reviewed based on these rules.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Anil, you might be talking, I think you might be talking about the communications condition of certification. So you might want to take a look at that section possibly if I think there might be language to the effect of what you're talking about.
Okay. To bring this one just to a close for now, I'm sure we're going to discuss this again. I do think there's an opportunity here for ONC to give some guidance on the relationship between cures, BAAs under HIPAA, et cetera, outside of the regulations themselves, in more kind of like user-friendly terms. Is that reasonable as a recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
Mark, sorry, you've given us more work. It's not even inside regulation now. Thanks a bunch. Mark?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. Are you updating the document, or are you not near a computer?
Oh, I can do. I can shove it in. That's fine.
Because I was just typing some stuff, but I want to make sure. It sounds like I want to make sure you all capture your...
And again, Mark, I'm reading through this language, and every reference I have to contracts is with respect to, for example, contracts to prevent users from sharing or discussing technological impediments to information exchange, or prohibiting or restricting communication, Those are the contexts in which contracts are discussed, and I don't see any place where contracts where BAA terms and data use rights are discussed in the term in the context of contracts.
Yeah, I mean, so again, I'll just say within preambles and preamble and take a look. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right that generally speaking, we refer to contracts in a broad sense, and I don't know that there is specific discussion of BAAs in that context. We do talk about BAA some in the regulatory impact analysis. I know that, but
Okay. The other, I'll get some notes in there in a second around some guidance. I also put in while I was thinking through this potential whether there would be a national security exemption.
Interesting.
Partly because of the work that I've been doing with VA and DOD.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, DOD data, I have a lot of experience with this because we maintain data for the DOD, PHI for the DOD, and DOD data on personnel. DOD personnel is classified as readiness data, which is held at the highest level not quite the highest level of classification, but certainly from an information security and SRG perspective, is classified at the highest level of risk. So it's associated with FedRAMP high, not FedRAMP moderate, it's either the highest or second highest level of SRG compliance relative to DoD ATO. So again, we could that's probably gobbledygook to a lot of people. I'm sure Andy and I are in the same wavelength, but somebody could come and ask me to share information about DoD members. That could be a permissible purpose, but it may not be. This may be sharing effectively readiness data that is sensitive.
And let's take it a bit further. DoD personnel who have served, been discharged, are now receiving care through veteran through the VA. And certain aspects of their clinical notes still have elements which would be considered to be necessary and secure.
Yep, that's right.
So it's, and they receive.
Andy, can you give me a for instance on that? Because when I read your note initially, I wasn't quite getting the idea of the former personnel.
Okay, without giving having any national security issues in my example. Where an individual has received treatment for wounds which were received in particular areas of the world, where an individual has received care from a military provider in various places inside the world, in various different geographical locations, where they've received treatment for particular wounds received whilst undertaking specific activities. So all these are things which would appear and do appear inside narrative clinical notes routinely.
Yeah. And my readiness example would be an example of a geographic area that's been affected by, for example, flu in areas that would lead an adversary to conclude that
operations were commencing in that area.
That or that a particular area is weak or amenable to attack by that adversary.
I see. So the fact that there are these textual notes in people's clinical records that make reference to sites of warfare or operations, et cetera, and that those, so we're saying that, but then how do you... So how does the VA share anything? Because, most of the veterans, they're all veterans.
The VA doesn't
right?
share anything, so that's a different, that's yeah, a different
was
question.
Saying, was that an ironic statement, Destiny?
I mean, I get stuff from the VA, so I'm just trying to, how would we apply this as an exception?
Okay, because the VA shares, because a lot of there is manipulation of records, so that sensitive information is redacted. First of all, to what extent does 21st century QoS even apply to DoD and BA? Mark, can you give us that?
Are you talking about specifically in the information blocking context?
Yeah, are they covered, or are they given some great broad exemption anyway?
Well, no, I would just say you'd have to go through the analysis of who's covered under the information blocking provision. Do they fit into the definition of at least one of the four actors that are identified?
Yes.
Are they dealing with the EHI? Do they have the requisite knowledge component? Is there an exception? Is it required by law? That's generally like the framework we're looking at.
Required by law is probably the blanket out, though, for relative
yeah.
national security.
Now, when I was thinking about this, I was actually, okay, do we just want to acknowledge the fact that with a better integrated care system, and let's be straight, both DoD and VA provide care to their covered people and their dependents via the paid care commercial network. And Stephen just said he gets stuff from VAE all the time. So it's not like there's it's not like a linear process. You go from DoD, they provide you care. You then get discharged, you go to the VA, they provide you care, and then you go somewhere else. It's much more of a interconnected ecosystem. And we are certainly beginning to share more information. And the two massive EHR programs which are underway inside those organizations right now is going to be even more information sharing. It would be good if there is meant to be some exemption for that we embrace it here, I think, rather than it's at least acknowledged and stated and we know how to handle it, if there's supposed to be one.
This is Anil. This is probably not a good question, but doesn't the current exceptions already include provisions for that? Both the privacy and security ones say that if it's not legal to do it and you don't share, then you can't be accused of information blocking. So wouldn't that be covered if your policies?
I would think if there's a general blanket, unless prohibited by law, that would actually be more the blanket that would address that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It sounds like that's more in a definition of where we get into the definition of information blocking, which actually Mark and I had a little conversation offline about that, because that we're not actually looking at the definition of information blocking in any of the work groups, because that's taken verbatim from QoS. And does that definition, Mark, actually have lawful inside it?
It has required by law. It says, these are bad acts except as required by law or covered under the reasonable necessary activities that ONC is going to lay out.
It'll be interesting. Maybe we should talk to Lauren about this, given that she's the VADOD person on high tech. But actually, because she's not saying anything. And it'll be useful to know whether it's an exception that they have just assumed they have, whether it's something they would wish us to include. Would that make sense, Alan?
Yep, I agree.
Cool. Okay, that's the first hour of the meeting. And now, is the group okay if we move on to the actual main content of the day?
Yay!
Reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, 171.206. Where did we get inside this?
Not very far.
I feel that we got through A, and we were...
We did get through A.
B. we've got to B1 scope of rights. But then I think we stopped at the end of that.
So, sorry to interrupt. So, there was another request for comment, the complaint process.
I was going to come back to the end. Mark, we have to get through Van today, I'm afraid.
Okay, sure. Yep.
Okay. So, 171.206(b)(2). Reasonable royalty.
Sorry, just reading again.
Yep. So it's got to be non-discriminatory. I assume, Stephen, this was you highlighting key things like independent value, standards essential.
Yeah, I'm the red. It's just things I thought we needed to think about.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
One confusion I have, and I think it was a confusion that is sort of inherent in this, is the notion of royalty as opposed to fees. So the fees for cost recovery all speak in terms of fees. This section speaks in terms of royalties, but royalties are typically used in the term of licensing of IP. Whereas the definition of an interoperability element is much broader than an IP consideration. So the use of the word royalty confuses me. This
and
is an area
Owen,
where I'm...
provide us any insight there? Mark?
Sorry. Can you repeat it one more time?
The word royalty.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that word, and what are you getting at?
I mean, I think all I can really say is we're looking at royalty in a basic sense of the word. I'll look in the preamble to see if we get into the specifics, but I mean, I think our position is that it's a term that's the meaning it should be pretty self-explanatory, I guess.
Well, royalty refers to patent holders, right? Royalty is a sum of money paid that you pay to a patent holder for use of a patent.
The term, the reason there's royal in there is that originally it was a king's right that was granted.
Well, yeah, obviously it's an English thing. Actually, it comes from the old French, royal, but there you go.
Right. I mean, we're talking about someone who owns the license here, though, so I think it's the same concept.
No, if I offer a service, this is again where the language I think is somewhat confusing. If I offer a service, I'm running, managing, and operating a service that meets the definition of an interoperability element, but I'm not licensing any IP. I'm merely running a service and charging you for the use of that service.
Oh, okay, so. Is this a different, is this going back to royalty or is this a different issue?
No, it's going back to the term royalty where typically I wouldn't think of the fee associated with the service that I'm running as being a royalty. I would think of it as a fee, a license fee, a service fee.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all I'll say is I can look into our thought process on that, but you know, we have the section in the preamble, and you know, just generally speaking, I think we thought that it was a term that fit the purpose within this exception that we were trying to explain. But again,
can you look into that and really whether it does fit? Because royalty, you know, is used generally, obviously, in the patentee approach, or where you actually you share a percentage of revenue in lieu of asset use or something like that. So you say, okay, I'll give you a 20% royalty because I'm going to be using your asset. That doesn't seem right. what you were getting at. I think Aaron said it. It seems like much more that it's a reasonable fee.
Okay. Yeah, I'll look into it. I mean, I think that the difficulty with fees is if you use a term like that, it would blend in even more. Aaron was saying about the differentiating between cost reasonably incurred and this licensing exception. So, but that's just a consideration. But yeah, I'll look into it.
If it's a licensing, so we just say reasonable license charge or something like, or reasonable charge or. Okay. Have a look into it. But royalty does seem to have a bunch of connotations which are distinctly unintended.
This is Sunil. Okay, sure. I'm not sure I agree, guys. I think royalty is an appropriate word here. We're talking about getting paid for giving someone or extending the rights to your IP, whether it's a book or whether
it's
a patent or...
No, we're not.
I thought that's what we were doing here.
No, we're not. That's the issue.
It is.
Nope.
Let me give you an example. I'll give you the purest example that I know how. So let's say I take an open source component and I host it in AWS or Azure, you know, some other cloud provider. And there's zero IP that I'm licensing. Maybe I even make the code that I use for that hosting also available under an open source license. Nonetheless, there is still some value that I'm offering by actually doing the hosting and actually working with AWS and, you know, taking on some of that activity. It meets the definition of an interoperability element. It meets at least two definitions of the interoperability element. I think definition one, definition five. But it is not a piece of IP that I am licensing.
Okay. I'll read it more carefully, but I thought the concept of licensing was embedded in here, but maybe I'm...
Yeah. So I'm not sure I'm following, Aaron. Can you explain that again? Because to Neil's point, this exception is about licensing of the interoperability element. So I guess I understand you. Your point is that maybe that our definition of interoperability elements.
It's a royalty for the use of interoperable elements. And as we discussed last time, the term interoperable element is really any doohickey.
Right, but I mean, I think the way we're using interoperability element is it's a means of getting that data. And you're talking about services, can you explain why services?
This is related to my general confusion between 204 and 206. Most of my experience is not licensing software or IP. It is running a service. It is a SaaS service, and it's sort of irrelevant as to whether I've written the code or stood up open source code and hosted it on a machine that I own or whether I use AWS. I'm running and operating a service. There's some value for that service. I am somewhat uncertain. I was, I think, reassured and then maybe now not reassured. Somewhat uncertain as to whether the fees that I charge for running that service are adjudicated under cost reasonably incurred or adjudicated under RAND license?
Yeah, so the way you're describing it, again, I'm not trying to interpret, but 204 has to do with the cost that you incur for things like for providing the access exchange in use of the EHI. So seems to me what you're describing would fall under 204. 206 is specific. Ooh. I mean, it's in the title. It's licensing of interoperability elements.
Yeah, but an interoperability element is a functional element of health information technology where I'm interpreting health information technology under 42 USC 300JJ. So that's whether hardware or software that can be used to access, exchange, or use. And I don't believe function element is a defined term. And then any other means by which electronic health information may be accessed, exchanged, or used. So this is the source of my perennial confusion between 204 and 206 in the context of running a service.
Right. Well, I think this is, again, just a hypothetical situation. But I think what you're saying is there's a service. I think the service itself would be fall under 204. While you're doing the service, you use an element like we're talking about, and there's a license of that element, then it could go to 206. I mean, I know it's not, I'm not trying to break down this example, but 206, I mean, in the title, we're very clear it's licensing. That's the issue there.
Okay, but Mark, are you saying then that the 206 is designed to be me licensing my IP?
Well, all I'll say about 206, I guess, you know, we explain the intent of 206 in the preamble. You know, I don't want to try to ad-lib that.
Yes or no would be fine. But 2III is talking about where I have actually, the interoperability element, I am actually licensed from an SDO.
Sorry, you cut it out and hit the last part.
Sorry, 2III is talking clearly about where I as the actor have licensed an interoperability element from an SDO.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not my IP at all. So this whole conversation comes from whether royalty is the right word. Well,
it's even more of it, which is I'm just trying to figure out 204 versus 206, and I'm now a little more worried than I used to be.
We'll come back to 204, don't worry.
Yeah, okay. I also struggle with definition 5 and definition 1 of interoperability element, where definition 5 is any other means, and I have a hard time distinguishing any other means from, again, my issue with 204 versus 206, but what I'm offering in my hypothetical service is a means.
Arian, I don't think you should get worried about 204 versus 206, because 204 is about recovering reasonable costs. 206 is about licensing and making reasonable profit. And
this is why these are really essential. Understanding these two are really essential. But I'm just trying to ask a basic question, which is the service that I'm running a means by which health information exchange may be accessed, exchanged, or used? Or is it a functional element of health information technology that could be used to access, exchange, or use health information for any purpose?
Well, it says, interoperability is to refer to any means by which EHI can be accessed, exchanged, or used.
So I think my service is an interoperability element.
So would you be licensing your service, though?
That's not what is in the definition of interoperability element.
Right. I'm just saying you're asking whether it would fall under 204 or 206. And a key aspect of 206 is the licensing aspect. So even if you're making the argument that a service could fall under the definition of interoperability element, there's still the absence of a license.
I see. So your perspective is the term royalty is deliberate, or license fee may be a broader term that might be better than royalty, and that 206 is really only intended to address use of license fees. I guess what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to form a whole set of subsidiary organizations that drive license fees to the part of the business that operates the service so that I can claim the license fees that I'm using to operate the service as a reasonable cost for my cost basis.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. All I'll say is that, the intent of 204 is that an actor can recover costs reasonably incurred for providing access, exchange, or use, And the intent of 206 is that an actor can make a reasonable amount of money for licensing of interoperability elements that allow for the access exchange or use of information. I think that's distinct to me. I guess I'm still not understanding where there's a gray area there, but again, very open to recommendations.
Yeah, so I was following logic that said that the service is a means by which health information exchange may be accessed, exchanged, or used, assuming that I could charge fees under 206 and then getting tripped up under the term royalty. I think what you're saying is that the use of the word license under 206 implies that we're talking about only cases where there are capabilities that are truly offered under license?
Yes. So, I mean, also just take a look at 206, like I have it on the screen. A good way to look at it is we say to qualify for this exception, each practice by an actor must meet the following conditions. And I know you guys think you might add all of the following conditions at all relevant times, which, you know, I understand the point there. But the first one is just responding to a request for license. So that's, you know, that's one of the conditions.
Request a license or use. It does say license or use.
Right,
so
but
I use a service, I license IP or content. It's IP.
Okay, well then let's go down to, I see your point, and I guess if there isn't clarity about that, I think our intent is that this has to do with licensing of interoperability elements. And I don't think we use service as an example, but I understand your point about the breadth of our definition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Arian, you straightened it out a bit now on or more understanding of 206 versus 204, or the intent anyway.
The intent, absolutely.
Okay, so let's go back to the language of two. My personal view is the term royalty is unhelpful. I think Arian agrees. I think Anil disagrees and says that royalty he thinks is fine and right. Stephen has been mute.
I don't have an opinion one way or the other. I'm just trying to understand it.
I'm a doctor, not a lawyer.
This is where the doctor don't have an opinion. Okay. I'll take another one at this, mainly to see if I can get Anil to see where I'm coming from. I struggle with royalty because it has a connotation that either it's my IP, my own IP, as opposed to potentially that of a third party,
mm-hmm.
or that there's some kind of linking of the royalty to the use that my client is going to make of it.
So Andy, I get where you guys are coming from, but when I look at this provision, let's assume that you had a bunch of LLD elements and I, as a customer, wanted to use them to do interoperability. You know, I'm not going to get smarter people than me to figure out whether the royalty is the right word or whether licensing is the right word. But I've always used the word royalty in our conversations when you expose to me a set of capabilities and technology where I'm using it now, not you. I'm using it to go do something related to interoperability, and I'm paying you based on that ability for me to use your technology. And so think about for example, the AMA will license a CPT. We pay royalties for it, right? Now, if I now do create something that uses CPT codes for another client, that client might also pay me royalties, and then I would have to pay derivative royalties or royalties back to the AMA. So the third party thing doesn't bother me. That happens all the time.
They actually call it a royalty.
Call it a royalty. They absolutely call it a royalty. I'm not the expert on this, but I know that when we license content and capabilities, We will pay a royalty fee as IBM to a group that makes that intellectual property available to us. And now if we now create something new, we will expect that the client pays us a licensing fee, and likely it's going to be a royalty, so that they, when they call it a royalty, it means something different for the way that they look at that particular fee as well. And again, we got to get smarter people, but that word, I believe, was chosen on purpose because of the way it's treated.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think there's like a, there's probably not one definition that can be decided on, but I just quickly did a little search, and in a business dictionary, it says compensation, consideration, or fee paid for a license or privilege to use an intellectual property or natural resource, and some other stuff. So, I mean, that seems to be what we're getting at.
Yeah. then I believe, relative to all the rest of the discussion, that the term interoperability element would be much clearer if it was actually defined as intellectual property. Because, you know, I do agree that royalty is a reasonable term to use with respect to all forms of IP and IP licensing. It wasn't obvious to me, and maybe this is just the source of the meta confusion, it wasn't obvious to me that that was the intent of this section. But understanding that's the intent of the section, that it's really about licensing IP, then it's probably a reasonable term to use.
It is, if that's what it's about, but that's why I got...
That's why I got confused too.
Well, you've got two III,
somebody else's IP.
Right, so
right, but that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, licensing
is
licensing.
Royalty, then, is it? By the definition of royalty,
it's still royal. I mean, what you're basically doing is you're collecting someone else's royalty for them, but you're passing it back to them. So, if you have a solution that happens to use the AMA CPT codes, it's a perfect example of your solution. You're going to collect it, but then you're also going to give it back to the AMA. So that happens all the time.
That's a great example.
I'd like to make some margin.
Well, you may not be able to if you're using someone else's IP, but hopefully that was a joke.
Well, that's the point.
But,
I'm kind of serious. You know, does that mean that I need to somehow carve out where I'm using third-party IP in any of my solutions and pass back their royalty, and I can't actually make a margin on the section of the solution that's theirs? I don't want this to inadvertently... discourage innovation and discourage third-party solutions.
No, I don't read it that way. I'm not saying is that you can't make money off of it. I think what they're basically saying is you have to apply it in a non-discriminatory way, and you have to be on a level playing field. You can't pick and choose who you want to do business with because you may think that someone might compete with you down the road. I think it's the general theme that we see in this, right? I think if you have a program where you're licensing interoperability elements through a robust and fair with your friends and competitors alike, then I don't see where the issue is.
Okay, what I thought this paragraph was trying to do was say that in granting the license, you're not going to gouge somebody on the charge to use it. That's like what I thought the intent was, but it sounds like that might not be the intent.
I'm going to put the AMA out of business.
Let's not have that conversation here. but I thought the intent was not to be charging egregious pricing. I thought that was what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
So I'm confused, though. What are you looking at that makes it seem like that is not the intent?
I'm looking at the way that 2i, 2ii...
It was reasonable, yeah. How is reasonable defined? Reasonable is not defined in terms of value.
Yeah.
Well, again, just going to the... I if it's not clear, we want to hear from you all. But, I mean, just in the title of the exception, licensing of interoperability elements on RAND terms. I mean, RAND is a... It's a... you know, commonly used term and the meaning has to do with reasonable and non-discriminatory and not gouging people. So I guess I'm confused.
Yeah. The reason I brought this up, because if I change the word royalty for charge in that entire paragraph, it makes complete sense to me.
I'd suggest we keep going on to the other sections and just bracket this as an issue.
Yeah, and I would, this is why we have you guys to make recommendations. I think if the group agrees, that's definitely something you can recommend.
And we can have part of the group said this and part of the group said that. Okay, is royalty the right disagreement across groups? Okay. Three, non-discriminatory, are we going to park all of two at this point?
Well,
there's no reasonable
test. Is that okay?
No. Although the word reasonable is used across the entire rule set.
So what is the test of reasonable?
Yeah, in the context of IPR associated with standards, RAND or FRAND, as it's sometimes also called, is used in the context of standards essential IP, where a standards body wants to license something as a standard, but there is some patent holder, and you know the intent is to make sure that the patent holder feels comfortable including their patent rights in the standard, and that standards users feel comfortable incorporating and using the standard. And so typically reasonable has the implication of being low and not impeding use of a standard. I'm not sure that's the intended use here. I'm not sure what is reasonable.
My interpretation was that whatever you're going to charge for the access to the interoperability element is a sensible and not gouging charge.
Let's say there was a medical society that created content for encoding, I don't know, of procedures that required a major payer.
Yeah.
Under what terms would that medical society's fees associated with that procedural terminology be considered reasonable or not reasonable? Everybody would pay this hypothetical fee, but not because it's the best terminology ever, but because it's required by the largest payer in this hypothetical country.
So I would imagine that what's reasonable is what the market is willing to tolerate without actually going back to the payer and saying, no way, we're not going to pay this anymore.
This is Anil. I mean, I think we should flag this as a area where we need either a test of reasonableness or we need a broader, a more specific definition of what is reasonable, because I don't think we're going to be able to solve that on this call.
I think that's very reasonable.
Just say that reasonable comes up 289 times inside the tiers.
Yeah, and also I think it depends on whether there's an alternative, right? I mean, for certain things there is no alternative, and therefore the word reasonable has no meaning. For other things there are alternatives, and reasonable could simply be market. Something to do with what is tolerable in the market.
Now you're going at my proposed way of better addressing this entire confusing section on fees. which really gets at that question, which is in cases where there is a potential for rent-seeking behavior, I think there's a rationale for tighter regulation of prices. In cases where there is no potential for rent-seeking behavior, it seems to be non-problematic to let prices be determined based on value to actors.
As long as it's consistent and non-discriminatory, I think that would make
as long as it's consistent and non-discriminatory, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. We do not want to stifle what we think is an amazing marketplace for innovation and capitalistic behavior that guides innovation. So I would agree with that.
Okie doke. Should we continue to the section and then
okay. Let's
circle
move on.
Back?
Yeah. 2I, I don't think we're going to have any concerns over. It's got to be non-discriminatory, whatever it is. 2II, okay, independent value. Stephen's highlighted it. I have a moderately visceral reaction. Both those words, independent and value, are heavily overloaded words. What was it? What's it say in the preamble around that?
It's basically trying to avoid against rent-seeking situations. If the only way that you can, so let's give another example that's totally hypothetical. Let us say that to open up an API to an EHR, that EHR charges a subsidiary fee for licensing some doohickey, and that the price for that is based on discouraging access to that API. Or has the effect of discouraging access to the API. I think that's what's intended.
That's
you can't make me. You can't make me license something just because it's. That's the only way to access data. You have to license me something because I actually want the thing that you license.
Okay. So what the actual preamble says. The reasonableness of any royalties will be assessed solely on the basis of the independent value of the access to technology to the licensee's product, not on any strategic value stemming from the actor's control over essential means of accessing, exchanging, or using health information. For instance, the reasonableness of royalties could not be assessed based on the strategic value stemming from the adoption of the technology by customers or users. Switching costs associated with technology or other circumstances of technological dependence. This is a curious preamble.
You know, I think what they're saying is that if you're going to make money on the parts of whatever you do that is not specifically related to access, exchange and use of health information related to this interoperability element. So whatever value adds, Aaron, you mentioned this last time, whatever value add you do, that's fair game. But those elements that are specifically for the information sharing, they have to have independent value.
No, I understand exactly right? what it says, and I agree with your interpretation. That's what the intent is.
Yeah, so I think that makes sense, right?
Well, I understand what it's saying. I'm trying to work out whether there's a maybe it's deliberate. It seems to be quite market pushing the market in a particular direction. Incidentally, this paragraph does describe the royalty base and rate as well, which does seem to indicate a very clear use of the term royalty in this paragraph. Which we probably need to look at. But yeah, okay. It does seem to be very market directive. Is that the intention, do we think?
I mean, this is Anil, but I would think, yeah. I mean, they want us to innovate on everything around the use of information, not the actual exchange of it, which should be relatively, you know, commoditized and straightforward. And so if we all want to innovate around it, we can, but not in that specific activity.
Yeah.
And then, as Arian put it, I mean, if there are a bunch of us doing this sort of work, then the market will go to whoever does it well and does it better. But no one should be monetizing interoperability in a way that would, you know, build businesses out of just that act itself.
Beyond recovering reasonable costs.
Yeah, of course, right.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, but it means that when you have an organization, let's say I've got a health information exchange, which is only reason for living is to exchange that information. Would this exception feasibly kind of make them borderline untenable? At least they can't be a profit-making entity.
This is the discussion that I think we need to go back to cost recovery.
Yeah, I'll just chime in here just as far as intent. I mean, we say it in the rule, but, you know, just generally speaking, we take the position that health information is not a commodity that should be bought and sold in the same way that other commodities would be. So just in the scope of all of this conversation, that's kind of where we're coming from.
But you go further than that. Access to exchange or use of health information is not a commodity that can be bought and sold.
Right, but we tried to strike the balance between promoting innovation and competition and allowing reasonable profits, but also saying that you can't, you know, really gouge or take advantage of the circumstances or your position.
Right. Yeah, but there's a long gap between recovering costs and gouging. There is a big space between those two poles.
Well, this is part of the issue. Yeah. Part of the issue here is that the reg text, the commentary contemplates profit and cost recovery, whereas the reg text I read is contemplating only cost recovery. But then I think there's a different way of getting at the policy goal that I think is really well articulated. I'll be proposing some alternatives here.
Yeah. Okay. So the independent value of the access technology to the licensee's products.
That seems clear enough.
Why don't we move over this? I think we've got some questions relating to this section. Maybe I'd suggest we go to 3.
Yeah, because 3 is so straightforward.
Because 3 is super straightforward. at least we'll be additionally novel sources of confusion.
Okay, if the actor has licensed the interoperability element, okay, so through an SDO, in accordance with the SDO's policies regarding licensing of standard essential technologies on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, the actor may charge a royalty that's consistent with such policies. Okay, standard essential technologies. Well, SDO's license interoperability elements broader than standard essential technologies, right?
Some SDOs may, in some cases, require membership to access IP.
Yep.
Which is not a standard essential technology, but is at least a cost that needs to get passed on. Maybe that would be done There are organizations. Again, let's take the hypothetical example of a medical society that licenses procedural terminology that's used by the largest payer in a hypothetical country. Licensing terms may actually require not only that the licensor but also the license that the data requester and the requestee both have access to that license. And this is, again, not standards essential. But maybe that would go under fee basis. It's super confusing.
Yeah. I find this one, I am tripped up on standards essential technologies because, you know, what you've just described isn't actually a technology. What you've described is an information asset.
Yep.
Right. So what is an example of a standards essential technology?
Yeah, so typically the definition of a standards essential technology is an IPR, so an intellectual property right that is reasonably required or formally required in order to use the standard. So, you know, in the example of electronics, there may be a patent for some sub-technology used for Wi-Fi that some organization has developed. There are, for use of video codecs and audio codecs, there are specific compression algorithms that have been done under patent.
Yeah, but Alan, so, this is in the context of an SDO.
Yeah.
So let's list out the SDOs. It's SNOMED, it's HL7, it's...
Well, I'm trying to give the general definition of standards essential.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but I'm trying to within the context, I'm trying to think of what SDOs actually have standards essential technologies.
It's much more likely, I think your point is, it's much more likely that IPR is licensed through copyright than through standards essential technology.
Okay, I'm looking in the... Okay, Mark, I'm reaching out to you with an olive branch asking for help here, okay?
Yeah.
The preamble talks about Microsoft Corporation versus Motorola, Innovatio IP Ventures, and Realtek Semiconductor. Help. The SDOs in this particular... sphere. There's, you know, I just named two of them. That's
are you on page?
Chunk of them.
Are you on?
I'm in the
what page are you on?
I'm in the
472
preamble,
or
479.
479. Okay. Yeah. So what's the question?
Well, okay. When you say charged pursuant to a commitment to an SDO to license standard essential technologies. The actual SDOs we're talking about in the healthcare space are HL7 and SNOMED, right? And a couple of, well, not CPTs. And what are the examples of standard essential technologies that are going to be licensed by HL7 or SNOMED?
So Regan Streif and Loink would be another, right?
But Regan Streif's not an SDO.
So, was your question about the case law that we cited to, or?
I think Andy's point here is that the case law is really important in the consideration of standards that are associated with technology, and that there is a good body of that, but that not much of that's actually that applicable to health information exchange. The practices that are involved here are much more about copyright than they are about royalty stacking.
Yeah, well, I mean, so just as background, you know, we did a lot of research and looked at case law, and because this is a new area of law, what we did was we looked at what we thought was a standard that could be applied, and it, in reading this case law, we thought that the idea of RAND terms, though as you noted, it is generally used in the SDO context, we felt like there was a symmetry there that we could use and that it would be applicable and make sense. You know, I guess that's all I can really say. But if you disagree, of course,
that's helpful. I do struggle a bit because in the health SDO space, I can't come up with a single example of a standards essential technology. You know, because fire is not a standard essential technology.
I apologize, but I need to drop at this point because I've got a conflicting.
No worries. This is all too riveting for you, was it?
Yeah. It is riveting. I got thoughts, but I'll write them up over the weekend.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good weekend.
Okay, look, we'll part this one.
So, Andy, when you say there's no technology, what do you mean?
A standards essential technology, okay, mm-hmm. I get as a term. I'm trying to come up with an example that an SDO would be able to license of a standards essential technology.
A crosswalk table. Wouldn't a crosswalk table be standards essential technology?
Not technology.
Why not?
Why is that technology?
Well, I mean, are we saying that content is health information content is not in the broader HIT? I guess we're talking about the definition of technology now.
It does depend on the definition of technology and also standard essential patents, because none of it's actually patented. I'm going to have to do some joined up thinking myself, I think. I think I'm going to have to take this one off to think about. I appreciate the fact that, you know, Mark's specifically called out there the language. Mark, in this, do you mean standard essential technologies or standards essential technologies?
You know, I could look into that. I think if we put standards in there, I think that's what we mean.
That's a good point, though, because in the preamble where you're citing the case law, you say standard essential technology.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good point, and that is an inconsistency, and I'll look into that. But is there a key difference in the meaning that you are pointing
absolutely.
At?
Absolutely, because in this paragraph right now, you're talking about a standards development organization, okay? An organization that's developing standards, okay? Later mm-hmm. in the paragraph, you use the term standards again. If apps mm-hmm. don't mean that, you mean standard essential. Actually, maybe you don't.
I think we mean the same thing.
I think you mean the same thing. Yeah, I think you mean, and the standard is a friend. Assurance.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay. Your point's well taken, but I agree.
The meaning is the same thing. It's just a discrepancy. Okay. I'm going to take this one off to think about. I'm happy to move on. This whole paragraph has been fun. It's obvious from the preamble that you guys thought about this for weeks.
Yeah, I mean, this is background. Weeks is an understatement. I mean, there's a lot of research done on this, and We did work closely with FTC and OIG on a lot of these concepts, yeah, and the terminology and all that. So, without weighing in one way or the other, I'll just say it is a very complicated thing, as you're seeing, and finding the right balance and the right terms is tough. So any help you can give us to improve the language would be appreciated.
Yeah, and I'm trying to work out actually whether this paragraph might potentially disincentivize an SDO from declaring something standard essential. Because it intrinsically becomes less valuable because of this.
It becomes less valuable.
It does. And it's one of those big
because they can't
around.
Charge as much for it.
Correct. Although in at least the world of the, and then does that actually matter given the two SEOs that I've been citing on this call, which are the predominant ones in the space, one of them doesn't charge for his IP, and the other one has a national license which is paid by, NLM. But does it even matter? Well, it might not matter now, but it might matter in the future. And the last thing I think we want is the SDOs to say, we actually don't want to make stuff standard essential. Okay, I'm going to have to have a think about this.
Well, I mean, and just, I understand that this terminology is loaded, so it's a key to get it right. But, I mean, the purpose here is just that the actor may charge a royalty that is consistent with those policies. That's the key point. I understand that the first part is very important that we get it right, but just a note there.
Yeah, just in the spirit of full transparency, so you guys are aware, I'm on the board of HL7 as well, who's one of his SDOs. So just so everyone's completely clear.
Yeah.
So I do actually, and what I can see, maybe not in our SDO, but in another SDO, would be, well, it actually reflects our policies to take into account this.
Yeah.
So that's not helpful either.
Right. So it seems like, just in closing this one, you agree with the intent of what we're getting at. You just might have some tweaks in language potentially. Is that right?
Unintended consequences. Notwithstanding the fact that I don't like the term royalty, but yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Non-discriminatory terms. I'm quite okay with this one, actually, apart from, as Stephen's outlined, objective and verifiable. A bit like reasonable.
Yeah, and again, so many of these things seem to me that they will be applied in the context of a complaint. Right? Someone will bring a complaint of information blocking, and what will be asked is for the entity that's the object of the complaint to be able to present objective and verifiable evidence, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Stephen. I mean, one of the key things to remember is that every situation is going to be very fact specific and based on specific circumstances. And, in thinking through all this terminology about reasonable and objective, all of that, if you think about the landscape of health IT, it's really hard to come up with terms that would be applicable, that are narrower, in my opinion. So the reasonable standard and other kind of those types of standards that are legal standards often would be applied by OIG, who would be enforcing this.
Yeah, I think that's important thing, that this is being mindful of the fact that there's a high level of contextualization to what is reasonable, what is objective, and what is verifiable, which will change over time and situation.
And this is Anil, and I think you need that in order to make sure that we don't end up getting ourselves into an unintended consequence situation, since healthcare is changing. As long as that group that is making those decisions is staffed with peers who understand what is a standard practice, so they can identify those that are not standard practices. If it's not, then I think this is not the right way to go. but I was assured last time, Mark, you said it was.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, I don't control the budget, but we are going to do everything in our power to staff with the right people. Yeah.
Right.
This seems to be one of the prime benefits that having a group like HITACH is, that it can provide you with that objective and verifiable and, you know, broad assessment within a particular context. Anil, would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree, but I don't think we want to be in the business, or we as a FACA team committee, be in the enforcement or verifying or review.
No,
I mean, I think we can make suggestions on that board,
exactly.
On that review board. But I think the one of the things that I would say is that, and I don't know the rules well enough to know whether this is in there, but we also have to make sure that the burden of filing a complaint and then having it reviewed doesn't get to the point where those that have very deep pockets see this as a cost of just doing business. I don't remember the language in there, but I think this particular one where we talk about licensing components, you don't want to be in a situation where the simply the cost of supporting this kind of regulatory mandate gets folded into their cost that they're going to charge back to their
users. I'll just note that I don't think it will, because under CURES, you can be fined up to $1 million per violation if you're a developer, network, or exchange. So pretty significant.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps. But for some vendors who, with a single client, are, you know, in the history of their client, might be bringing in $500 million, $1 million fine. My point is if you start to think about it as a business and amortize those fines that you may be leveled, that might be leveled against you, and then try to fold that into the cost of running your business, I think that should be discouraged, if you will, within the rules.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I get it.
Okay. Well, that's the end of two for now. Oh, actually, no, sorry. We're on three. Forget that. Yeah, I was okay with 3II. It's just the standard non-discriminatory pieces. Stephen, Anil?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I mean, there's still questions that I wrote. I think I wrote a note below a while back about, you know, how do you verify if it's. But I think it's the same usual concern that I've been having. Yeah.
Yeah, I think proactively or retroactively, the answer is probably both.
Well, I don't know how you would do it proactively. You know,
there'll be some guidelines, I think.
Well,
and I think I can see that there'll be some published guidelines about what those terms should be. I can see that.
Mm.
Well, one can hope. Four, contractual terms. Okay. It's an exclusion. The actor must not require the licensee or his agents or contractors to do or... Okay. The actor must not require not compete. Okay. That must not require to not compete. No.
Yeah, that makes
Is that
sense.
Right? Well,
that
yeah. must
yeah, that
must
makes
not,
sense.
Must
that,
must require
yeah.
to not compete.
Right. So if I license my components to you,
yeah.
I can't
yeah, yeah,
tell
yeah.
you,
no,
Andy.
No, I'm just
saying,
you
know, you
I understand the principle. You're in our competition. Got that.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Okay. And it must not require exclusivity. Yeah, must not require additional licenses. Must not require. Yep, into IP transfer to the actor. Okay. That's an interesting one. I'm sure that was even part of that collateral term. Hopefully. Accept reasonable royalties. Unless it's a reasonable cost. Okay.
Well, actually, I have a I was going to say I have an issue with number four, license grant, assign or transfer to the actor any intellectual property of the licensee. That seems like it prohibits any kind of bartering arrangement, which is quite common in our industry. Am I reading that right?
It's saying. It's trying to prevent an actor requiring the licensee.
Requires.
Yeah.
Okay. They could do it, but they can't.
Okay.
They can't require it. Yeah. They can do it. They can barter, but they can't require there to be a barter. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it can happen, but it must not mandate it. So I actually read it like three times.
That's school and not law school. I'll tell you that.
Can you imagine how well we'll get on at law school? We say too much. Okay, but 4B. I think I'm twitching at 4B because I'm channeling my alien probably. But it's saying the only fees can be a royalty or... to meet reasonable costs. Am I reading it correctly, Mark?
Yeah, and I think that makes sense.
Well, it does make profit.
It's basically saying that there's these two different categories of allowable costs that we're talking about, reasonable royalty and cost reasonably incurred in 204.
The royalty is a charge.
Okay, sorry, you're right. Terminology. So, charges. So, reasonable royalty and cost reasonably incurred. You know, we've laid those out. So, those are the exceptions to this. But otherwise, you can't require to pay a fee of any kind whatsoever beyond those two.
Only be a royalty or cost recovery.
For this element, for this stuff, I mean, we could do business
for any interoperability element.
Yeah.
So, just use an example. Does that mean then that a health information exchange, anybody who's connected to it, can only recover its reasonable costs under 204, or a royalty where there's some kind of licensing going on for any of its APIs? That's the only charges it can make.
Well, and just a note that we do say in preamble, Arian's pointed out, it's not in reg text, that we consider reasonable profits to be included as costs reasonably incurred.
That's an interesting, I'm glad you pointed that out to me. An interesting read of the term cost.
you're talking about for 206, for 206, not for 204, right?
No, we're saying that you can make a reasonable profit under 204 or 206. The idea is that we want people to be able to innovate and bring new products to the market, but it would still have to be reasonable, the terms. You know, I think that still fits in the construct of cost reasonably incurred and RAND licensing. I mean, we're still talking about reasonable profits.
Okay.
Now, that policing profits of commercial entities is a really interesting decision.
Well, it happens in utils, right? Anyway.
Okay. I think we're...
But as always, you know, if that point isn't clear or you need more clarity on any of that...
You've made it crystal clear.
Well, no, I mean as far as your recommendations go, you know, we're trying to improve on everything. So, if you have recommendations,
No, I get it. What I'm trying to do is work through the healthy balance, because I see what we're trying to do with this to not stand in the way of innovation, but we also don't want to disincentivize innovation. Because if there's no healthy profit that can be made by someone who's innovative, then why would you bother?
Exactly. I know we have to take public comment, but that's the point.
Yep.
If you don't allow any profit, what is the incentive for people to push the limits and make new products and innovate?
Let's open to public comment. I agree with you, Mark.
Makes sense.
Operator, can you please open the line?
If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to move your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. Okay, we pulled the phone number up just to give folks time to dial in, but do we have anyone in the queue at this time?
None in the queue at this time.
Okay. So, Mark and Andy, I think we should probably just wrap up on this last recommendation, or at least on this last section, before we conclude. But anything else before we end the public comment period?
No, I don't have anything, I guess. Andy, you have anything?
On what, sorry?
Just any other issues regarding, I guess we're trying to close up this conversation. Do you want any other recommendations?
Was there a deliberate use of the word trade secret instead of intellectual property in the under five?
Under five? Oh, let me take a look.
And then, Mark, while you're taking a look, operator, have we had anyone dial in?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there was, that definitely is a deliberate term. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the question beyond that.
Only because, well, elsewhere we've been talking through intellectual property in other rules, but not trade secret.
Yeah. Andy, this is Anil. What do you mean? What's the issue with it? I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying.
It's a very deliberate use of a term. I'm trying to work out whether we meant the same thing.
Well, if I license someone intellectual property, I have to disclose to them what it is that I've licensed them. But if it's a trade secret, by nature of it, I don't have to disclose that to them. So I could have a non-disclosure agreement. And then if I do happen to share it with them because of the business I'm doing with them, I could make sure they don't share it with anyone else because it's a trade secret. So I think that's an important thing.
I agree. And I think that's the intent.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that was quite a positive.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Don't we have the USTA that covers this anyway? So, okay.
It just goes to, like, you know, the again, like, we're not trying to say you have to be so loosey-goosey as to to not be able to have a non-disclosure agreement, but it has to be a reasonable one that you're requiring.
That's fine. That's fine. It was just the way we used the language inside it. I'm fine, and it was helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm actually I'm okay with it because that seems pretty clear and straightforward. Anil, Stephen, was I ahead on that one?
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
Agree.
And then the D was pretty self-explanatory. So basically, I think the outstanding is paragraph two, and then the details of objective and verifiable, and then four, five as well. But you know, guys, it's really obvious the amount of heavy lifting that's gone into drafting this.
Yeah.
So we're not trying to make sort of like recommendations which are unhelpful or ungrounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll second that. We spent so many months waiting for this rule to come out, and you know, I don't think anybody had a good sense of how much work was going on behind the scenes to put this together. The deeper I dig into this, the more impressed I am with the work that you guys did to draft it.
Thank you very much. It's
amazing.
That's really great to hear. Thank you. And I do want to say I think these conversations are really helpful for me, and they're really, I think, helpful for us moving forward. So thank you guys.
Well, you're welcome. Okay, without wanting to start another conversation in the last 5 minutes, I'm happy to give people 5 minutes off before you go to the weekend. Has anyone got anything else you want to raise?
No, look forward to seeing everyone next week.
Indeed.
Right. Thanks for your leadership, boss, Andy and Michael.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for your time today.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone. Okay. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. All right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Take care, team. Bye-bye.